Fresh Art International presents conversations about creativity in the 21st century. This is Fresh Art International. I'm Kathy Bird. We've been sharing conversations about creativity on this podcast since 2011. Today, we contemplate the role that teaching artists play in shaping the art school experience. How does an artist in academia cultivate expressive opportunities for students while making time to deepen their own creative practice? New Orleans-based artist Christina Molina invites us to look beneath the surface of this challenging dynamic at the art school where she teaches, Southeastern Louisiana University's Department of Visual Art and Design. We drive an hour north from the Crescent City to explore a faculty exhibition in the university's gallery and sit down with a dozen of the artists who teach here. Her East Indian roots and late-blooming queer identity inform the immersive multimedia environment that Garima Thakur constructs. I really want to dig into the project that you have on view here, the Bioscope, that you created in 2022.
Let me place it in like physical reality. So Bioscope is a box. It's an artifact and a product and an object and an experience of my childhood. It was something that was more analog, like imagine like a really, really colorful box and a guy is like pushing it and shouting, Bioscope, Bioscope, Bioscope. And all the kids gather around it. And
they're looking through little portholes to see images inside. How did shame become the subject of such a work?
I tried to really just do the traditional route that is expected, and something just always felt off. Like, you know, I couldn't articulate the feeling. Growing up in an extremely collective culture, I realized the primal mode of that feeling was shame. And I started to dig more into it. I think feelings are signposts or information data points. The first person I talked to was my mother, who told me shame is an invisible line that you never cross. I talked to professors. I talked to queer activists. I talked to students. I talked to other mothers. So the whole process starting by interviewing. I tried to distill it and look at shame through media perspective, through internal perspective, through performance perspective. And then the idea of the Bioscope came in my dream, where I just wanted to contain it in an object. And a Bioscope is perfect because there is loops of shaming. Someone's watching you watch something, and you know that someone is watching you watch something, but you can't help but do it.
You started noticing the word shame appearing in the films and series that you were watching, and you started capturing that. And that became integral to the video project itself.
A lot of Bollywood movies. There's a movie on Tina Turner in it, Matrix.
Korean drama.
Do you have no shame? That was a question that was asked so commonly. And it was really interesting to me. I wasn't looking for it. But you know, once you start to see it, you can't unsee it, and it's everywhere.
What do you hope or expect that people might take away from this work?
My hope was that people could have an intimate experience. When it was first featured, it was in 5 different locations, and there were 6 people gathered around so closely looking at the work. I think even if you don't know the language, there is a lot of moments in it that talks about tonal variations, and you can see that there are aspects of matriarch. And anybody who has difficult daughters or difficult mothers or difficult relationship, the work is deeply rooted in ideas of Black feminism as well. I feel like it breaks respectability politics of Indian feminism. So my hope is that people can relate to that.
On the exhibition's opening night, Kate Bacheski presents the performance she titles Corpuscle with an electric meat slicer. Kate cuts slabs of clay and adds new layers to her expanding womb for a live audience. The slicer still haunts the gallery. Tell me how you came up with this idea.
I originally wanted to slice clay 3 years ago. I've been thinking about butchers and my family history and how in the old country, on my Austrian side and on my Polish side, my grandparents told me we had butchers and the material of meat is what they dealt with every day. So I drew a line between meat and clay and how clay is my meat. Then I was thinking about tools that butchers use and this idea of trying to dissect that material and investigate it a little deeper. So I've wanted to work with this meat slicer. It's followed me from Florida to Louisiana. I knew that if I assigned myself this tool of the meat slicer, it would force me to use it.
This is an electric meat slicer from a butcher shop, not something you expect to find in a gallery space.
Yes. I feel as though clay and ceramics get heavily rooted in the craft world. And the end objective of that world is to make an object. And there's so much leading up to the making of that object that is like a poetic ritual practice that's left unseen. All of those processes of evolution, slaking down, mixing, recreating, failure. And my end goal is never to have an object necessarily that will live beyond me.
I love the fact that you're referencing respecting the historic past of the craft. At the same time, you know the potential for it to be blown up into something completely different. We'll just say here that Kate is pregnant, so her stacking of the clay on her belly was referencing her flourishment as a pregnant woman. How is your pregnancy influencing your work?
It's pretty much all I can think about right now for many reasons, like the limitations my body has right now and the different canvas that I consider my body to be. It's just a different shape. I'm only able to move in certain ways. I'm making work that really focuses on the now. So once I have the baby, it will change after that.
It's an evolution. Crazy. What a creative process.
Definitely.
Mommy. Graphic designer Luisa Hernandez steps away from the subject she teaches to experiment with transmedia. Luisa repurposes small wooden blocks used in Montessori schools to translate recordings of her 3-year-old daughter into tangible forms.
It was more of an observation of her play, interacting with these objects that nested that idea of me repurposing those blocks to represent sound.
They're wood, and they're stained these beautiful, clear colors of the rainbow, really. And Luisa has represented 3 emotional exchanges with her daughter in this 3-part installation. One of them resembles a sunburst to me. It's on the wall and it's radial.
Her laugh.
There's one very linear, the bars of sound.
That's when she says, I love you, mommy.
She says it in Spanish.
Te amo, mommy.
Te amo, mommy.
The most complex one is representing a moment where your daughter is feeling anxious or sad or upset.
Right, she's crying, yes, and then I'm comforting her.
This is represented on a round pedestal low to the floor with rectangular shapes that represent her daughter on one side and Luisa. The energy of the two coming together, when we were standing in the gallery looking at these, we were thinking together about the importance of paying attention to those small moments, the discrete sublingual exchanges. As a graphic designer, this is a really pivotal moment for you in what you might realize with your creative energies.
True. It is different because you usually work with clients and you usually work with products and things that are really detached from your life. I work for industries. I like that I had that opportunity in a gallery, which is not a usual thing for designers. So for me, it was fun, really fun
it's
to do this.
A new dimension. Vanessa Centeno's affinity for hip-hop and the sensual influences her playful approach to mixed media.
I think in my work, I'm always curious about the essence of things. I think historically, thinking about painting and works on the wall, you almost like kind of want to look underneath all of the layers and behind and to see the process. So I think I really use that as a way of beckoning the spirit. Making forms, like manipulating my canvas into sculptural things, brings to life for me that body, that spirit that I'm searching for.
Let's describe this piece. How does it represent that exploration?
This particular piece was more of like kind of coming out or a night out. It's kind of pulling some of the materials that I use in my closet and kind of rearranging them, giving them a little swag. So this one has a little more of a style or swag to it that I really kind of fell in love with.
And the colors are bright, almost neon, some of them, the green and the orange. There's a purple shape like a hand, a gesturing hand reaching out of the center of the piece. So you do have bodily references in the form.
It's like fingers prodding at something or kind of searching in the dark. That happens a lot in my work where these things are reaching to me in a way, you know? So I kind of give them a pedestal to act out or display. It's not always like me telling it what to be. It tells us and reflects our subconscious minds. So I enjoy the play there too with the viewers. So
you were mentioning to me that you've become a mother recently and how that has impacted your work.
I've allowed my work to kind of be its own entity. And I think now I've shifted to where I want my work to represent me. That is a way for me to deal with the emotions and all the new things about being a mother that I'm still processing. I think there's more sincerity with the way that I'm thinking about making work. And yeah, it kind of becomes a rite of passage in a way. It is a new perspective for me.
Improvisation is key for Dale Newkirk. His geometric paintings evolve in a process that echoes the impact of nature and culture on the built environment.
Your work has moved from sculptural to two-dimensional and working with geometric shapes and color specifically. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about the keystone of the set that's on view is Post and Lintel.
That piece was done actually several years ago. It had been shown several times and ended up back in the studio and I hung it in my house. I had lots of time to look at this piece and I actually flipped it from being a vertical to a horizontal piece, which radically changed the composition. It seemed to work better than it did before. And I decided to make this new series of works on paper based on that same composition with the same proportions, which are based on the golden section, which is just a mathematical set of proportions that artists have used throughout much of art history and that you find in nature. And so that basic architectural element of a post and lintel structure or a T shape just came like a starting point. Because if you work intuitively like I do, I think of it like jazz music. You have to have something to respond to start, right? You can't improvise from nothing.
I'd like to think about that for a minute because you're responding to a form, the post and lintel form, but you're also working through it the surface of things, you know, not just the shape. Tell me about that. You're working with a heavy paper, but you really put it through some paces.
There might be 30 different paintings under the finished work as I struggle, and sometimes it is a struggle, to discover or find an image that I think resonates or has a visual tension or some kind of presence. So it's about sensibility, it's about touch, it's about materiality, color. In order to work with that, I take an electric sander to the work. I run it under water sometimes to get a translucent quality or to get back to older layers, which makes the surface more rich. So all that, though, is trying to create some kind of resonance.
And in some of the works, that process totally effaces the post and lintel that's behind everything. These works were all done in 2020.
2023. Mm-hmm. So what do you sense as a direction for your next exploration?
Well, I have four more of them going on in the studio. So it's continuing.
It's great to see work that's in process.
School chairs make cameo appearances in the paintings that Tom Walton shares with us, subconsciously telling the story of how he came to teach.
I didn't want to teach at first. I didn't really like the systems of like university education and how it didn't set people up to be artists. I really believed in teaching, and I believed in it enough that if it wasn't done right, I didn't really want to do it. So I did about a year of research. I read books on art education and really focused on my teaching philosophy and came to the conclusion that for me, the thing that matters the most is I think it's a gift when you're teaching at a university, because all of the students coming in, whether they have become conscious of it or not, are there of their own accord. There's something in them that's sort of driving them there. And what I find the most, you know, appealing is trying to activate that.
I don't think people realize how important it is to generate a sense of trust and a space where you can say what you think. I was just standing out with you in the gallery looking at two of your paintings.
I paint people because I'm primarily interested in people and how people relate to each other and how I relate to them. And then I think that it gets expressed a lot in the kind of environments they're in.
The two works mm-hmm. that are out there have no people in them.
The spaces are human spaces. It was an old building that had a lot of character. Those chairs became very purposeful. I found it at school. I brought it to where I was, painted them a different color. Again, quite instinctual, like why that chair, why that color? I don't know exactly right now offhand, though, I mean, maybe a good therapist could figure it out.
Well, maybe I just figured it out because you got the titles, Pathways and uh-huh. Listening Space, and you've got a school chair. It could be a stand-in for the student and the pathway, you're inviting them to find their path, you know, and you are providing them a listening space.
Well, definitely, I think almost all my work is autobiographical.
Passion for film and music are immutable forces in the collage aesthetic of Chad Serhal.
I'm always making music and thinking about motion picture video art, film, and then I'm physically making collages all the time. And then I kind of put them all together as much as possible.
Let's talk about Rotoscope. It's about your formation as a film lover. If you think about it, it's got 100 films represented. Tell me what it means to you, this piece.
Great American motion picture rotoscope animation. I wanted a very grandiose thing.
Name a few of the films that have influenced you that we would see in this piece.
I got really into movies in the early 2000s when these auteur directors like Wes Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson, I discovered David Lynch around that time, and Alexander Payne, and every year they would make a movie and it was just getting better and better and better. Spike Jones, that's another one. Charlie Kaufman was writing movies at the time and then it became like this great director.
You've got Hitchcock in there, Charlie Chaplin, the silent films, and Buster Keaton, and it's just mind-blowing what's in there. What we see is this distilled, discrete moment from a film that you registered in a way that makes it iconic to watch.
Yeah, 3 seconds, that's it.
3 seconds.
Yeah, I captured my favorite parts.
Yeah. You have an analog score that goes with this animation. It's a collaboration with your grandfather.
Yeah, I contacted him asking for 5 minutes and 30 seconds of a message on Morse code stylus, I think they're called. He recorded it to a cassette tape.
He's 80 years old now.
Since the mid-50s, he's had a station, a little setup in his house. It's there. It starts off beep, 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 beep. And then the music kind of goes with it. It's in there the entire time if you listen close enough.
Thank you.
Ben Diller grounds his gaze in stillness. He looks to and through architecture, and this shows up in how he paints and teaches.
What you're doing, based on your work that I've just seen, the analog, the observation, the human element is maybe more important than ever.
There's nothing that beats good, true observation. My students today are drawing both inside the gallery, responding to the elements of design within a structured space, or outside, where it's more kind of open to, you know, the conditions of light and wind, but they still have observation based on the angles, based on their sight lines.
Your work that's in this exhibition is a confluence of inside, outside. Tell me why that's important to you. You're providing so many layers.
We're all influenced by environment. My studio in New Orleans was an outside, inside studio. Working in that studio really inspired me, influenced me to take my work in that direction. I didn't plan it. It just sort of organically happened.
All the works except for one in the gallery space are linear. They're dealing with angles.
I work with a limited palette, kind of think of the nature and the greens.
You were describing how you work in chapters, like it's a narrative in a way for you.
It is.
Why is this chapter called Restraint?
We create this kind of restraints, we're contained, but yet we're also open to the interactions of the environment of light and shading and atmosphere. And so I like this idea to be ambiguous. It could be seen as maybe a negative, but also sort of positive, depending upon the context of the viewer or the experience that they've had, either with environment, with structures, or their challenges in their life.
You can see through all the spaces that you've shared. So there is a way out.
That's great. Or a way in.
Eric Huckabee ponders the power of hurricanes. His paintings study Gulf Coast storm patterns.
I was born in New Orleans, and I lived down in Venice, Louisiana, when I was younger, which is at the very mouth of the Mississippi River. I then moved to the Mississippi coast, where I live now, in Waveland, Mississippi, right on the water. It's a big part of who I am visually.
So that hyper-awareness that you have.
Yeah, it's built in. I'm fascinated by just the atmospheric qualities of this area in general. I'm at that point where my vocabulary, I think, as an artist, has very much solidified, and that the metaphor of weather and storms is much more ripe to tell stories with.
In the gallery, you're showing three works from a larger body of work that constitutes notes on the development of storms.
Right.
And we see the symbology, the arrows leading you to acute moments in the development of a storm, the clouds spinning, and this icon of a hurricane appears multiple times in the paintings. You told me it's only in the last year and a half that you've started really facing the hurricane itself.
How they define themselves and constantly expand and contract and move. Having grown up with that kind of weather event as a reality of how much it dictates your year, whether or not you evacuate or not, how it's changing your local landscape. I'm part of this environment. There's something about the fact that it's alive in a very obvious way is exciting to me.
The way Lily Brooks gazes up to photograph the sky gives us a glimpse into how deeply she engages with Louisiana's fragile environment.
Work you're showing here is emblematic of your interests, the cloud study. And I love this idea, we have to count the clouds.
So the title came from a conversation I had with a meteorologist. I was making a video and he walked up behind me and I accidentally recorded this dialogue where he asked me if I was watching the weather for him and I said, yes, sir, I am.
Is there any weather up here for me?
I don't see too much weather going on.
No, it's very quiet, but we got to count the clouds. Stratocumulus and cumulus. 70 miles visibility. Just barely.
So when I was editing that video, I thought that is the title for this project because it implicates all of us. The idea of watching the sky is at once playful and also it feels ancient, you know? I mean, that is what the earliest meteorologists were doing. They didn't call themselves meteorologists, but they knew when rain was going to fall or not.
And it's also about responsibility, taking responsibility for what's up there in a way, like our role how we respond.
Yeah, and it's a command, too. We have to, right?
You've been recording the clouds for how many years now?
So that project, We Have to Count the Clouds, I began when I moved to Texas in 2011. And so I sort of describe it like a vine with a bunch of ribs. One of them was photographing at weather stations. Another was photographing different forms of data collection, printed matter related to meteorology. I was also photographing the human body and thinking of it as an instrument itself. Also landscape images, places where weather events or climate change events have shaped the space. Some of the work addresses the built environment.
So you're tracking climate change. At the same time, you're tracking the weather incidents as a form of life and nature.
I don't think of it as being necessarily a truth of any kind. I'm not an expert, but I am a person who's interpreting it and feeling it. So the work is really rooted in my own emotional response and instinctual response because it's personal.
Rachel Harmeyer reveals her research interests and the aesthetics of science in embroidery that magnifies our view of tiny sea creatures.
I believe you're the first art historian I've met that also has a creative practice. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me that as you pursued this degree in art history, you felt you were not meant to talk about the fact you had a studio practice.
Yeah, I had to be a little bit in the closet about it. And so I had to turn a lot like N-word in a way.
Your interest is collage, needlework, fabric, working with textiles. Is that also the focus of your thesis?
Well, that's really funny because
I'm just curious.
I tried so hard to keep them separate, but it didn't really work out that way. My dissertation project was looking at the way the work of neoclassical artist Angelica Kauffman's work was reproduced in various media because people were looking at her prints. She blew up in visual culture. It was like, you know, it was kind of like going viral, but before the internet, so you see her work across media. And one of those mediums is embroidery, which I do love. And so I ended up getting to talk about a lot of needlework. The lines have started to become more blurred.
Your work is framed in an embroidery hoop. It's called Microcosm. This piece is a specific creature.
Yes.
A sea creature.
It was at the Grant Museum of Zoology. That's a Victorian Natural History Museum. I came across this wonderful installation of all these glass slides of marine animals, and I really fell in love with the sea pen. It's called that because it looks like a quill pen, like a feather. It was very tiny.
Very tiny.
I wanted to invite the viewer into the intimacy of looking, which is how I end up sewing.
So how does it feel to be out of the closet?
Well, it's fantastic. I love that I don't really have to hide that I love art so much that I make it sometimes, you know.
You don't just have to talk about it or study it or research it.
Yeah.
You making it, I think, adds a dimension to your ability to talk about it.
I think that we often think about like what art history can do for art majors. It's supposed to instruct them in the past, which of course is important. But I also like to think about what artists can do for art history, because I think creative and innovative approaches to tackling the thorny issues of art history's past, sometimes it takes a really creative person.
Christina Molina creates a diagrammatic display of photographs that reify the sun and its chemical elements. The work is emblematic of her love and concern for our fragile world.
I've learned so much from exploring the art that's being made by teaching artists here near the Gulf Coast of the United States. A very interesting place to be at this time in the world.
Yeah, and we feel that every day here. Living in a precarious environment that is affected and threatened by sea level rise, hurricanes, climate injustice. We're all invested in it creatively in different ways.
Let's talk about the work that you're showing here.
The title is Between the Diamond Dust and the Sun. That title is pulled from early experiments in geoengineering that hypothesized that in order to cool down the planet from the sun's warming temperature, because we have no more ozone layer left, or hardly one left, that there could be a veil of diamond dust
blown into the atmosphere and that would refract light and therefore cool down the planet. I think it's a bad idea, but it's a beautiful metaphor. I loved this kind of dissonance between this attempt to do something about our warming planet and that it would be beautiful, but that ultimately would probably be fatal. And it's like a perfect metaphor for how we've approached, you know, our relationship with the planet. And so,
our failure to look to the future of what we're, right, what toxins we're producing with our lives.
Right, right. This kind of scratching for our own survival and at the same time maybe creating beautiful systems that will ultimately fail us. And so that was one part or one consideration in making the work. And I started to think a lot about the sun itself and, you know, how do you think about something so complex in our solar system, in our universe, that is an energy force, but ultimately is the thing that we have to contend with. And ultimately over millions of years will also itself expire. I started to think about reducing the sun back to its elemental nature, literally. Like, what are the chemical elements that make up the sun?
How did you represent those?
Yes, so I represented them photographically. A photograph of the sun first, and then its six elements. Hydrogen, oxygen, neon, carbon, helium, and iron arrived at these pictures arranged in a grid formation on the wall.
It's sublime in its way.
Thank you. And now I've actually made a video component where many of the still images are moving, and I have this sound of the sun that I cited from NASA and some images of the sun studying the different elevations, temperatures, textures, solar flares that are incorporated in the video as well.
I'm Kathy Bird. This is the Fresh Art International podcast. Research and observation, architecture and the environment, memory and motherhood, music and movies, intuition and uncertainty. These are forces that inform and inspire the art made by teaching artists at the edge of Louisiana's Gulf Coast. Channeling the passion of emerging artists, connecting with relevant histories, current trends, and highlighting the ways from process to content. They come together to offer expressive opportunities to students. These artists remind us of the potential for teachers everywhere to shape the future of art. Channeling the passion of emerging artists, connecting with relevant histories and current trends, lighting the way from process to content while making their own art. They remind us that those who teach can indeed forge an inspiring creative crucible. If you like what you're hearing, please take a few minutes to rate and review our podcast. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Emily Hall Tremaine Foundation, Locust Projects, and the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, and listeners like you, make Fresh Art International possible. When you visit our site, you'll find episodes about art and culture from around the world. Stay tuned for more contemporary art talk.